Welcome to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring the random prompts of Daniel Rosehill as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters. Join us for deep dives into AI, technology, and whatever other random thing Daniel finds fascinating today. Subscribe on Spotify or your favorite podcatcher. Now, today's episode.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hi there, Herman and Corinth. We've talked a lot lately about, I think, a very interesting topic that's going to become very more topical over time. And that is, how do we prove that what we record with digital devices is real and unmodified and untampered with? And this gets us into digital forensics and digital evidence, which is an important topic. Also related to the question of AI, as we've been discussing, how do we prove that something is AI generated? And on the flip side, how do we prove that something isn't AI generated? But one of the ways that we traditionally validate that something is real digitally or is an unmodified copy is with checksums. And I think there's an interesting analogy in checksums between the concept of apostilles with paper, validating the pieces of paper, someone's passport or their birth certificate is valid. There's a process for that. So I'd love to talk today, Herman and Corn, about checksums. And I always have to say, I've always wondered when you go onto a website, like you're downloading an Ubuntu ISO file, right? And let's say you verified that you're on a legitimate website, it's not man in the middle, all that stuff. Why do you actually need in that case to Why do you get the checksum? Because they commonly will have download the checksum and they show you that. There's also not one single type of checksum algorithm. There's different ones like MD5. What are the pros and cons? And beyond digital evidence and validating the things are untampered with, what are the practical reasons why one might want to calculate checksums in their daily computing life?
Hey everyone, welcome back to My Weird Prompts. I'm Korn, and I've been thinking a lot lately about how we actually know what's real in the digital world. It's becoming such a massive issue with generative media and deepfakes, but today we're looking at something a bit more foundational to the concept of truth.
And I'm Herman Poppleberry. You're right, Korn, it's the classic problem of digital provenance. Our housemate Daniel actually sent us an audio prompt about this earlier today while we were having coffee. He was asking about checksums and why we still see them everywhere, even when we're downloading stuff from trusted sources.
Yeah, he used a really interesting analogy, comparing them to apostles for physical documents. You know, those official certificates that authenticate a signature on a public document for international use. It's a great starting point for thinking about how we verify digital assets.
It really is. And it's one of those things that most people see on download pages, like that long string of random-looking characters next to a download link, and they just ignore it. But in the world of data integrity and security, it's absolutely vital.
Exactly. So today we're going to dive into the world of checksums. Why do we need them? If I'm on a legitimate website like the official Ubuntu page, why does it matter if I verify the file? And what's the deal with all these different algorithms like MD5 or SHA-256?
I've been waiting to geek out on this. It's such a perfect example of how a relatively simple mathematical concept keeps the entire internet from falling apart.
Let's start with the basics for anyone who might be unfamiliar. What exactly is a checksum?
At its simplest level, a checksum is a small-sized datum derived from a block of digital data for the purpose of detecting errors that may have been introduced during its transmission or storage. Think of it like a digital fingerprint. If you change even one single bit in a massive file, the fingerprint or the checksum changes completely.
Right, so it's a way to ensure that the file you have is exactly the same as the file the creator intended you to have. But Daniel's question is the one I think most people have. If I'm downloading from a legitimate HTTPS secured website, why is this extra step necessary? Doesn't the browser handle that?
That's a great question, and it's where things get interesting. Yes, HTTPS secures the connection between your computer and the server. It uses encryption to make sure nobody is eavesdropping or tampering with the data while it's in transit. But HTTPS only covers the transit. It doesn't tell you anything about the state of the file before it started moving or after it arrived.
So you're saying the file could be corrupted on the server itself, or maybe even on my own hard drive after the download finishes?
Exactly. Think about bit rot. It's a real thing. Over time, the physical media where data is stored can degrade. A single bit on a server's hard drive could flip from a 0 to a 1 due to cosmic rays or just hardware failure. If that happens, the file is corrupted. HTTPS will faithfully deliver that corrupted file to you, and your browser will think everything is fine because the connection was secure.
I remember we touched on some of these hardware vulnerabilities back in episode 223, when we were talking about digital survival. The idea that the physical infrastructure isn't as permanent as we like to think.
Precisely. And then there's the issue of mirrors. For large projects like Linux distributions, they often use a network of mirror servers all over the world to distribute the load. You might think you're on the official site, but the actual download link might point to a mirror at a university or a private company. While most mirrors are honest, a malicious actor could potentially compromise a mirror and swap the legitimate file for one that contains malware.
So the checksum acts as an independent verification, even if the delivery mechanism is compromised or the source is a third party. As long as you have the correct checksum from the original creator, you can verify the file's integrity.
That's the core of it. It's that second layer of trust. It's like if someone gives you a sealed envelope. You trust the person who gave it to you, but you still check the wax seal to make sure it hasn't been tampered with since it was created.
Okay, so that explains the why. But let's talk about the how. Daniel mentioned different algorithms, specifically MD5. I see that one a lot, but I've also heard people say it's outdated or even dangerous. What's the story there?
Oh, MD5 is a classic. It stands for Message Digest Algorithm 5. It was designed by Ronald Rivest back in 1991. For a long time, it was the gold standard for checksums and even for some security applications. It's very fast to calculate, which made it popular.
But speed usually comes with a trade-off in cryptography, right?
Always. The problem with MD5 is what we call collisions. A collision is when two different sets of data produce the exact same checksum. In a perfect world, every unique file would have a unique checksum. But because a checksum is a fixed length for MD5, it's always 128 bits, and the amount of possible data is infinite, collisions are theoretically inevitable.
Right. The pigeonhole principle. If you have more pigeons than holes, at least one hole has to have more than one pigeon.
Exactly. But for a hashing algorithm to be secure, it should be computationally impossible to find a collision. In other words, nobody should be able to intentionally create a second different file that has the same MD5 hash as the original. The problem is, back in the mid-2000s, researchers found ways to do exactly that with MD5.
So a hacker could take a legitimate piece of software, add a backdoor to it, and then tweak the file slightly until its MD5 hash matches the original software's hash.
That's exactly the risk. It's not just a theoretical concern anymore. In 2008, researchers even showed how to use MD5 collisions to create a rogue certificate authority certificate that could be used to spoof any website. That was the final nail in the coffin for MD5 in any security-sensitive context.
Wow. So if I see an MD5 hash on a website today, should I be worried?
It depends on what you're using it for. If you're just checking to see if a large file downloaded correctly and wasn't corrupted by a bad internet connection, MD5 is still perfectly fine. It's very unlikely that random corruption would coincidentally result in a collision. But if you're using it to verify that a file hasn't been maliciously tampered with, MD5 is useless.
That's an important distinction. Integrity versus authenticity. MD5 can help with accidental integrity issues, but not intentional authenticity challenges. So what's the alternative? I see SHA-256 a lot these days.
SHA-256 is part of the SHA-2 family, designed by the National Security Agency. SHA stands for Secure Hash Algorithm. The 256 refers to the length of the hash in bits. It's much, much stronger than MD5. As of right now, in early 26, there are still no known practical collision attacks against SHA-256. It's the standard for everything from verifying software downloads to securing the Bitcoin blockchain.
It's interesting how these things evolve. We went from simple parity bits in early computing to these incredibly complex cryptographic hashes. I'm curious about the performance side, though. Is SHA-256 significantly slower than MD5?
It is slower, yes, but on modern hardware, the difference is negligible for most users. Most CPUs today have built-in instructions specifically for accelerating SHA calculations. You can hash a multi-gigabyte file in a matter of seconds.
So there's really no reason not to use it.
Not really. In fact, we're even seeing a move toward SHA-3, which uses a completely different internal structure called a sponge construction. This is to ensure that if a fundamental flaw is ever found in the SHA-2 family, we have a safe alternative ready to go.
That's some forward thinking. It reminds me of our discussion on BGP hijacking in episode 231. The internet is built on these layers of protocols, and we're constantly having to patch and upgrade them as we discover new vulnerabilities.
It's a never-ending arms race. But checksums aren't just for security and big downloads. Daniel was asking about practical reasons for calculating them in daily computing life. And honestly, I use them all the time.
Really? Give me an example. I don't think I've manually calculated a checksum in months.
Well, think about backups. If you're moving a large amount of data, say your entire photo library from one hard drive to another, how do you know every single file made it over perfectly? You could just look at the file sizes, but that's not reliable. A file could have the same size but contain corrupted data.
So you'd run a checksum on the source and the destination.
Exactly. There are tools like rclone or TerraCopy that will do this automatically. It gives you that peace of mind that your data is safe. I also use them for identifying duplicate files. If you have 10 different folders with temporary photos in them, you can just hash all the files. If two files have the same hash, they are identical, regardless of their file names.
That's a great tip. It's much faster than trying to compare them visually or by metadata.
And then there's the world of file systems. Modern file systems like ZFS or BTRFs actually use checksums at the block level. Every time they read data from the disk, they calculate a checksum and compare it to the one stored when the data was written. If they don't match, the file system knows there's corruption.
And if you have a RAID setup, it can even use the parity data to automatically fix the corruption, right?
Exactly. This is what we call self-healing storage. It's incredibly powerful for preventing that bit rot we mentioned earlier. Without checksums, the file system would just hand you the corrupted data and you'd never know until you tried to open the file and it crashed.
It's fascinating how this one concept scales from a simple error check on a download page to the foundational integrity of our entire storage infrastructure.
It really does. And it goes even deeper into software development. Think about Git, the version control system that almost every developer uses. Every single commit in Git is identified by an SHA-1 hash of its contents and its parent's hash.
Oh, that's right! I've seen those long strings of characters in Git logs, so the entire history of a project is essentially a chain of hashes.
Exactly. It's called a Merkle tree. Because each hash includes the hash of the previous state, it's impossible to change a single line of code in the past without changing every subsequent hash in the history. It makes the entire history immutable and verifiable.
That's a brilliant application. It's not just about the current state of the file, but the entire evolution of the project.
Its integrity across time.
Okay, let's go back to Daniel's apostille. Analogy for a second. An apostille is a physical stamp or certificate. If I'm a regular person using a computer, what's my stamp? How do I actually use these checksums?
Most operating systems have built-in tools for this. On Linux or Mac, you can just open a terminal and type SHA-256-sum followed by the file name. On Windows, there's a PowerShell command called getFileHash. It's very simple. You run the command, it spits out a long string, and you compare that string to the one provided on the website.
But let's be honest, Herman. Most people are not going to open a terminal every time they download a file. It's a friction point.
You're right, it is. And that's why many modern applications handle it behind the scenes. When your operating system downloads an update, it's almost certainly verifying it with a checksum before installing it. When you download a game on Steam, it's doing the same thing. The goal is to make it invisible but omnipresent.
I wonder if we'll ever see a more user-friendly way to do this for general downloads. Like, maybe the browser could automatically check the hash if it's provided in the metadata of the page.
There have actually been proposals for that. It's called sub-resource integrity, or SRI. It's already used by web developers to ensure that scripts loaded from third-party sites haven't been tampered with. Your browser checks the hash of the script against a value provided in the HTML code. If it doesn't match, the browser refuses to run the script.
That's fantastic. So it's already happening for the web itself, just not necessarily for the files we download manually. This ties back into what we were saying about AI content. If we can't trust the pixels, we have to trust the metadata.
Exactly. We're seeing this now with the C2PA standard. It's basically a digital apostille for images and videos. It uses cryptographic hashes to link a piece of media to its origin and its edit history. If you see a video of a politician saying something wild, you can check the C2PA manifest. If the hashes don't line up with the original recording, you know it's been tampered with.
It's a necessary shift. In a world where we can't trust our eyes and ears, we have to trust the math. Checksums and digital signatures are the only way we can establish a ground truth in the digital realm.
That's the second-order effect Daniel was hinting at. It's almost like we're reinventing the concept of notarization for the digital age.
And just like a notary has to be a trusted party, the source of the checksum has to be trusted. This brings us back to why you need to get the checksum from the official site, not from the mirror you're downloading from.
Precisely. You always need an out-of-band way to verify the integrity. If a hacker can modify the file on the mirror, they can also modify the checksum listed on that same mirror.
I'm curious about the limitations, though. Is there any scenario where a checksum isn't enough?
Well, a checksum only tells you that the file is what it claims to be. It doesn't tell you if the file is good or safe in a broader sense. A perfectly legitimate, verified file could still be a piece of malware if the original creator was compromised or malicious.
That's a great point. It's integrity, not morality.
Exactly. It's like the apostle analogy again. An apostle proves that the signature on the birth certificate is real, but it doesn't prove that the person named on the certificate actually exists or that the information on it is true. It just validates the document's origin.
So we still need other layers of security, like antivirus and common sense.
Always. Checksums are just one tool in the toolbox, but they're a foundational one.
Let's talk a bit more about the different algorithms. We've covered MD5 and SHA-200-FT6. What about things like CRC-32? I see that one sometimes in zip files.
CRC stands for Cyclic Redundancy Check. It's a very old and very simple algorithm. Unlike cryptographic hashes like SHA-256, it's not designed to be secure against intentional tampering at all. It's purely for detecting accidental errors in transmission, like a bit getting flipped on a noisy network cable.
So it's even weaker than MD5 in a security sense?
Oh, much weaker. It's trivial to create a collision with CRC-32. But it's incredibly fast and requires very little computing power, which is why it's still used in hardware like Ethernet controllers and in simple file formats like ZIP or GZIP.
It's all about choosing the right tool for the job. You don't need a heavy-duty cryptographic hash to check if a small packet of data made it across a wire.
Exactly. If you're building a bridge, you use steel and concrete. If you're building a birdhouse, wood and nails are fine. Using SHA-256 for every single network packet would be massive overkill and would slow the internet to a crawl.
I like that. It's a good reminder that more secure isn't always better if it comes with unnecessary costs.
But for anything that lives on your hard drive or involves software that you're going to execute, you definitely want the heavy-duty stuff.
So, for our listeners who want to start being more proactive about this, what's the Herman Poppleberry recommended workflow for a new download?
Okay, here's what I do. If I'm downloading something important, like an operating system image or a security tool, I first make sure I'm on the official website. Then, I look for the checksums or hashes link. Usually, it's a separate file, like SHA-256-SUMS. I download the file and the checksum. Then, I open my terminal or PowerShell and run the hash command on the file I downloaded. If the result matches the string in the checksum file, I'm good to go.
And if it doesn't match?
I delete the file immediately. Don't even try to open it. It could be a corrupt download which might just cause the installer to crash, or it could be something much worse. It's not worth the risk.
It's a simple habit, but I can see how it could save you a lot of trouble in the long run, especially as we move toward more decentralized ways of sharing files.
Oh, absolutely. Think about something like IPFS, the Interplanetary File System. It's a peer-to-peer network where files are identified by their hashes rather than their locations. In a system like that, checksums aren't just an extra step, they're the entire foundation of how you find and verify data.
That's a whole other rabbit hole. We should probably do an episode on decentralized storage at some point.
I'd love to. It's the logical conclusion of the trust the math philosophy.
You know, it's funny. We started this talking about Daniel's prompt about apostilles, and it really does come back to that idea of trust. In the physical world, we trust institutions and official stamps. In the digital world, we trust algorithms and mathematics.
It's a shift from institutional trust to cryptographic trust. And in many ways, cryptographic trust is more robust because it doesn't rely on the honesty or competence of a single person or organization. The math doesn't have an agenda.
Unless the math itself has a hidden flaw, like MD5 did.
True, but that's why we have a global community of cryptographers constantly poking and prodding these algorithms. It's a transparent, peer-reviewed form of trust.
It's a fascinating dynamic. I'm glad Daniel sent this one in. It's one of those hidden in plain sight topics that really shapes our daily digital lives.
It really does. And I hope this encourages people to actually look at those long strings of characters next time they're downloading something. They're not just random noise. They're the seal of authenticity for your digital life.
Well said. Before we wrap up, I want to remind everyone that if you're enjoying the show, we'd really appreciate a quick review on your podcast app or on Spotify. It genuinely helps other curious minds find us.
It really does. We love seeing the community grow. And remember, you can find all our past episodes and a contact form at myweirdprompts.com.
We've covered a lot of ground today, from the bit rot of physical media to the cryptographic chains of Git. It's amazing how much weight those little checksums carry.
They're the unsung heroes of the digital age.
Thanks for diving into the weeds with me, Herman. And thanks again to Daniel for the prompt. It's always a fun conversation when we get to talk about the intersection of math and daily life.
My pleasure, Korn. I'm already looking forward to the next one.
Me too. Until next time, stay curious and keep checking those hashes.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks for listening.
Bye, everyone.
Yeah.
You know, Herman, I was just thinking, if we ever do get that sloth and donkey collaboration going, we're definitely going to need some serious checksums for our audio files. Can't have any bit flip braying or slow motion distortion.
Ha! You're right. A single bit flip could turn a majestic bray into a digital screech. We'll stick to SHA-512 for that, just to be safe.
Good call. Safety first. All right, we're actually done now.
Actually done.
Talk soon.
Chiggas!
One more thing. I was reading about how some researchers are using DNA for data storage. Imagine the checksums you'd need for that.
Oh, that's wild. Error correction in biological systems is a whole different ballgame. We're talking about billions of years of evolution-tested checksums.
Exactly. Maybe we'll tackle that in episode 500.
It's a date.
Okay, really leaving now.
Bye.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox Turbo.
Thanks for listening to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring Daniel Rosehill's AI prompts, as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters including me, Cornelius the Sloth. Subscribe on Spotify or visit myweirdprompts.com.